I have to move it closer.
All right. Do you want me to start?
Please.
I'm Liana Knight McComas Kelly. You see, I'm using four names because each has played a very important part in my life. I was born November 15, 1920. That means I'm 80 and very soon 81.
Very good. Very good. I am Dale Niebuhr. It is October the 13th, 2001, and I am in the home of Mrs. Liana McComas Kelly, a Harford County living treasure. She's born in Dublin, Maryland, and has lived in Harford County her entire life. Good morning, Mrs. Kelly. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine.
Can you tell us about yourself?
Okay. My full name is Liana Knight McComas Kelly. You see, I'm using four names because each one has played a very important part in my life. I was born November 15th, 1920. That means I'm 80 right now, and very soon, 81. That date is interesting to me because when I was little, as soon as I woke up on the morning of my birthday, I could hear guns shooting. I thought someone was surely celebrating my birthday, but I soon learned that it was the first day of rabbit hunting season, and men were out in the nearby woods to get their rabbits, which they used for food in those days. I am a lifetime resident of Harford County, having been born in Dublin. Now, Dublin, 80 years ago, was really just a little crossroads where Route 136 and 440 intersect. Located here were McCann's General Store, where one could buy groceries, hardware, clothing, shoes, and just about anything you needed. Then there was the Dublin Methodist Church, the Dublin School for Elementary, grades 1 through 7, and High School for grades 8 through 11. There was a blacksmith shop, a creamery, where farmers brought their cans of milk to be taken to Baltimore Dairy. Then there were a few houses. Dublin had no post office and still doesn't have a post office. Mail was distributed through the street post office. Now, I think some today might come from Darlington, but where I lived, it's always been streets. My parents were Ralph Oliver Knight and Sarah Jane Walker Knight. When my parents decided to leave the little crossroads village, they bought a house and some acreage 1 mile down the road at the intersection of Route 1 and 136. Now, some of my sisters say it was 5 acres, others say it was 10 to 15 acres, and I always thought it was 10 acres. I was very young, and I don't recall that move at all. I was the second oldest of 7 children. I had an older brother, John Robert. I came next, Margaret Liana. Then I had a brother, Wilson Walker, and then 4 sisters, Jessie Elizabeth, Catherine Ray, Mary Jane, and Dorothy Ellen. Both brothers are now deceased. I once asked my mother where she got that name, Liana, because she had spelled it L-E-A-N-N-A. She told me that she once read a story about a Queen Liana. She thought the name was a beautiful, and so I, the first daughter, was heir to that name. I must confess that when I became a teenager, I was doing my thing and changed it to 2 words, capital L-E-E, capital A-N-N-A. And over the years, I've sort of regretted doing this because it's been confusing as I try to explain that my middle name is really Liana. Now the acreage, be it 5, 10, or 15, was a wonderful place to raise kids. We always had plenty of room to romp and play. There was a strict rule. We could never grow up our own property. And we were happy to stay right there, and we played wonderful games such as hide and seek, Mother May I, ring around a rosy, hopscotch, and then, our favorite, we played house. And such imaginations we had. I remember we gathered leaves, pebbles, twigs, seeds. We pretended they were vegetables. We stirred and stirred and made delicious soup. Then we made pretend sandwiches with large leaves put together with a little dab of mud. Daisies always served as eggs, and we had plenty of mud pies and cakes. When Amanda, my little granddaughter, was about five, she and I made a bakery using mud for pies, rolls, and decorated cakes. We had a wonderful day and selling our products for play money. In the winter, on cold, rainy days, we spent hours and hours playing school. I was always the teacher. The word babysitter was not known then, but I was the babysitter for many years. Back then, we had no TV, no radio, no telephone, no electric light, no indoor plumbing. Since everyone lived under these same conditions, we were content and didn't know any different. I have no idea the year, but I well remember the day I came in from school and was told I could flip a switch, and miraculously the bulb in the ceiling filled the room with light. No more kerosene lamps with those smoky chimneys. Then, I remember my father bought a radio. It was an Atwater Kent. We gathered around that radio every evening to hear Amos and Andy. With the electricity, we had water pumped in the house, a sink in the kitchen, and later a bathroom. I guess we thought we were rich. Now, let me go back a few years. My paternal grandparents were Wilson and Bessie Knight. Now, they lived on a little country road between Dublin and Berkeley. It was a great treat to spend a few days with them. And such an exciting adventure when my grandmother decided to go shopping. We traveled in a buggy pulled by her horse, Dolly. Dolly was a very gentle horse who plodded along on the narrow dirt road. The road was lined with cedar trees and scrubby pines. I can remember those trees. I can remember the open fields where the cows grazed, and some of the cows had bells around their necks. And as they moved about, the bell rang out softly. I can still hear that gentle clanging, which told the farmer where they were located. Arriving at the little store, grandmother tied Dolly up to the hitching post, and she went into shop, and of course I with her. I was so happy because I always had 2 pennies for candy. And I spent the entire time trying to decide the best choice and what I could get the most for my money. There weren't many books around in those days, but grandmother had one on her desk called Mrs. Wiggs and the Cabbage Patch. I guess I've read that book hundreds of times, and I'd still like to find one. Maybe I'll go to the library and look someday. Well, I seem to be skipping around. But back to my family. Our father was a blacksmith in the shop up at Dublin. Today, blacksmiths consider themselves artists, but back then it was hot, dirty work. He put shoes on horses, and I guess mules too. But when Conowinga Dam was built, our father worked there as a machinist. He became a very skilled person. He sharpened bits and drills. After Conowinga was completed, he worked for the Arundel Corporation, whose headquarters were in Baltimore. He was sent all over the country where tunnels went through mountains to make roadways. He was sent to San Juan, Puerto Rico, where he stayed for a whole year. The job there involved constructing airports and runways. To those of us back home, this year seemed like an eternity. Our mother never worked outside the home. In those days, women stayed home to manage the household and the children. I often think of how lucky we were to have her to greet us when we came home. No matter what or when, our mother was there. We always sat down to have breakfast, lunch, and supper together. How different today. Our mother was a skilled seamstress. She had a Singer machine, the old treadle pipe, and on it she sewed everything from our bloomers to evening dresses. She could even take hand-me-downs, tear them apart, restyle them, and they looked like new. And we were all happy with them. Yes, we wore bloomers and long brown ribbed stockings held up by garters. These stockings, shoes, fabric, and many other things were all ordered from Sears Roebuck catalogs. Even wallpaper was ordered from there. Once a year, we received this big, fat catalog, and I can tell you, we'd spend hours and hours going through that book, making lists of what we liked, particularly the week prior to Christmas. Then Santa Claus would choose one thing from the list we made and bring us that. Notice, just one thing. Each of us got one thing. How many times have I heard, "You better be good, or Santa won't bring you a thing," or, "Just keep that up and you'll get switches in your stocking." I suppose I believed in Santa Claus till I was 12 or 13 years old, afraid not to believe. It wasn't until Christmas Eve that the tree was brought into the house and decorated. This was done after we little ones were in bed. It was always a cedar tree which had been chopped down from any property within walking distance. Cedar trees were so plentiful that no one seemed to mind if you chopped one down. I can still remember standing in awe looking at that beautiful tree and then finding the right stocking, which was filled with candy, nuts, and always an orange on top. That orange was a real treat, because in those days we didn't have fresh fruit in the winter. I can tell you, we dragged that stocking around all day, maybe two or three days, making it last as long as possible. My favorite present from Santa was a printing set when I was about 10. I can still see that box. It is about the size of the Scrabble game today. It had the little blocks of wood on which were pasted, glued, the letters and numbers. It also had an ink pad. It was so perfect for making charts and posters for my play classroom. I think from that time on, I really wanted to be a real teacher. When I was six, I entered Dublin School as a first grader. I know I was so excited. My brother Bobby, who was 2 years older than I, had to walk the mile to school. And he had to be sure to get me after school so that we could walk together. We were warned very strongly that there were gypsies who roamed throughout the country, and they snatched little children and took them away. I really never heard of this happening, but I believe it could have. My first grade teacher was Miss Eula Hopkins. She later married Billy James. Now she lives in Colorado, and she just celebrated her 95th birthday. She earned $800 a year for teaching 9 months, and I'm still in touch with her. Going to school was just wonderful, and I really loved every minute. But when I think back, I know we had a good foundation of how to live a good life on our little homestead. We always had a cow for milk. We had 2 pigs, which were fattened up for butchering in the fall. There were chickens for eggs and roast. And we were always excited when our parents ordered those baby chicks from some out-of-town hatchery, and they were delivered by mail. But sometimes a hen would steal away and make a nest and lay an egg each day and sit on them until baby chicks hatched. And they were called second hens. Right now, I'm wondering how that chicken knew when to stop laying those eggs. Guess I'll have to call someone who might know about the habits of hens. Now, we always had a big vegetable garden. Our mother canned all summer long, and we kids picked blackberries by the gallon, which went into jam and jelly. But oh, those chiggers. it's spelled C-H-I-G-G-E-R-S, but we called them jiggers, J-I-G-G-E-R-S, and I guess they did make us jig. They were the tiniest little mites which caused dreadful itching. And then on our property there were lots of persimmon trees which bore fruit and were supposed to be good after the first frost. Now we never ate those persimmons, but we ate lots of green apples before they were ripe. No one had a taste for those persimmons, and those trees are all gone now. Now we picked chinkapins, a form of chestnuts, and I think they're gone too. Each small nut was enclosed in a prickly burr. I haven't heard of chinkapins for a long time. We found walnut trees and hickory nut trees. It was fun to crack these nuts and eat the kernel. But our hands were always stained bright green from those walnut shells. Now, I'm thinking of that butchering day, and that was a day I really didn't enjoy. Men came early in the morning, and they built a big fire. And then there was a huge barrel filled with water, and it was placed on an iron frame over this fire. The pig's neck was slit, and the body was hung up, so the blood drained out of it. It was then put into boiling water, brought out, and the bristles were scraped off. Then the pig had to hang for a day or two to get cool. And it was cut up in hams, tenderloins, bacon, on and on. Parts of it were ground up into sausage. Scraps were made into scrapple. I guess that's where the name scrapple comes from, scraps. And then we had something else that was called souse, S-O-U-S-E, souse. The hams were smoked or cured, and much of the meat was canned. Well, that's enough of that butchering. I really did not enjoy that day, but we stayed very close so we wouldn't miss a thing. Now, let's see, back a while ago, I left off when I entered first grade. I did go to Dublin School and started high school there, but decided to transfer to Bel Air High School. In those days, it was easy to make a move. You just had to ask permission. And I told them that I'd like to take typing, which was not offered at Dublin. So I was granted permission. I graduated from Bel Air High School, and Mr. Earl T. Hawkins was principal. I met my friend, Eleanor Dietz, there. And when we graduated in 1938, we went to State Teachers College at Towson together. Eleanor and I roomed together for the 4 years, and we graduated in 1942. We stayed friends all these years, and we are in touch with each other very often. It was in our junior year in Towson that our lives changed forever. On December 7th, a Sunday afternoon, a friend was taking me back to college after a weekend at home. And we heard on the car radio that Japan had bombed ships at Pearl Harbor. We were in World War II. I was employed during summer vacation in the gas mask factory at Edgewood Arsenal. I remember rows of women sat at long tables and rolled the rubber between our fingers, which was the face of the mask. We had to look for the tiniest imperfection and cast that out. We were warned that a hole left undetected could cause the death of a soldier. Another summer, I worked at Edgewood Arsenal in the ration office. There, we issued coupons for gasoline and tires for the government employees. It was necessary for people to carpool, and we checked on them when their application was made. At home in the evening, I volunteered to man a spotter's post. For hours, we searched for any plane which might come over our area and reported this. Since we were located so close to Aberdeen Cruisers Ground and Edgewood Arsenal, and kind of in direct route to Washington, it was possible that a bomb could be dropped in our airspace. All during this time, our windows had to be blacked out, all the lights were out, and people checked on us for this. We could not dare be a target for the enemy. We seriously collected many things for the war effort. Grease, aluminum foil, scrap metal, and I'm sure there were many other things. Each family was issued ration coupons for items like sugar, coffee, meat, butter. Even shoes were rationed in those days, and of course, gasoline and tires. It was impossible to buy hose, silk, or rayon. After graduating in 42, Mr. C. Milton Wright, who was superintendent of schools at that time, assigned me to teach second grade at Dublin Elementary School. Mr. Wright knew at the time that I would be close enough to walk to school if necessary, if I had no gas to get there. We were living through those awful war years. It was a horrible time. We heard of so many of our young men being killed. Many families upset. Then, on April the 12th, 1945, from my classroom, looking out the window, I saw the flag being lowered to half-mast. Our president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had died. Fear and dread swept the country. Vice President Harry Truman was sworn in as president, and people thought he was not prepared and would be a very weak leader. But this proved to be not true. 4 months later, on August the 6th, President Truman ordered that the atomic bomb be dropped on Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. And the war officially ended on August 14th, and I can tell you there was wild rejoicing. Okay, so I really have always been involved in community activity. At this time, I organized an athletic association for the Dublin community. We had softball games for all ages. With a small group of Dublin Grangers, we had lights installed on the ball field. I think this is probably the first school that had lights in the county. We built bleachers, and I took the lead in dedicating this field to those who had fought in the war. Local masons volunteered and built a base, and a plaque was installed. Recently, a great-grandmother told me that her knees are still hurting from when she was a catcher on that Dublin team. And all this took place before parks and recreation programs. I had wonderful students. In fact, I had one student in my second grade who later became state senator. Do you know who it was?
No. I don't.
It was Art Helton.
Oh.
I taught him in the second grade. And I still have a pack of papers from that second grade. Now, that was way back in, like, 43. And Art Helton got A+ on his math paper. So he was a good person. Okay, I left teaching and worked for Harford County Welfare Board from 1946 to 1950. The welfare office then was located in the Kenmore Annex. It was a little white building on the corner of Route 1 and 24. We had a director, a secretary, a finance officer, 4 social workers. This made up our entire staff. I was the first full-time adoption worker for the County Welfare Board. I traveled all over the state matching babies with parents. It was a very satisfying job. But I retired when I married William McComas. Now, he was a co-owner of McComas Brothers Hardware and Building Supplies. This is an old established business, probably 100 years old, located on Main Street in Bel Air, right beside the Ma and Pa railroad tracks. It was this railroad that brought many cars of supplies to our business. There were spurs beside every warehouse and coal bins. The cars were backed onto the spurs where they were unloaded. We had carloads of lumber, fertilizer, lime, coal, farm equipment, many things. The railroad is long gone, but some of those old buildings are still standing. One is presently rented to Napa Auto Parts, one to the Pioneer Cleaners, one to Craft Corral, and the old livery stable now houses the Bel Air Auction. When my husband's brother, Alex McComas, died very suddenly from a heart attack, I went down to help. To boost the business, I actually drew up plans for four houses, hired a contractor, supervised the construction, and arranged for financing. Now, this was long before permits and inspections were necessary. I can't recall any problems we had. The houses are still standing and in excellent shape. We had one son, William A. McComas Jr., who is now married to Leanne Majorly. That's spelled M-A-J-E-R-L-E. They have two children, William J. McComas and Amanda Lee McComas. It's great joy to me. For many years, I found myself doing hours of volunteer work. I worked at St. Margaret's as a volunteer secretary perhaps for 15 years. During this time, the convent was built for the nuns. The addition was put on St. Margaret's School, and the new church was built. It was a very busy time. Reverend Terrence Evans was pastor. I did this work many evenings and was glad to help the church. I was named as lay corporator along with Ed Higginbotham. I served on the First Parish Council. And during this time, I also did long-term substitute teaching at Bel Air Elementary School. I had a third grade, another time a fifth grade. I could write a book on these wonderful experiences, and I'll stop and show you one right now. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Heart Association of Harford County. I received a letter from the Maryland Heart Association in April of 1954 saying that they'd like to start a unit here in the county and asked me if I would organize it and get some people together. I did this, and the first meeting was held May 25th, 1954. Now, Dr. Helen Tossig, capital T-A-U, S-S-I-G, who was president of the Heart Association of Maryland at the time. She's a well-known blue baby specialist. And Dr. William S. Love, professor of cardiology at the University of Maryland, came to that first meeting. We had a nice big crowd of people. I sat beside Miss Mary E.W. Ristow, and on the other side of me was Dr. Tossig. And when it came time for nominations, Miss Mary jumped up and said, "I nominate Leanna McComas." Now, I didn't really want it. I didn't feel I was capable of doing it. But Dr. Pawlik said to me, go ahead and take it, because if you serve your term, you won't have to do it again. And she seconded that motion. Well, I could hardly get out of it, so I became the first president of the Harford County Heart Association. I had a wonderful board of directors, including Dr. Heumann, Dr. Sidwell, Dr. Kaiser, Dr. Liu, Dr. Dudley Phillips, Peter Rodman, Sidwell, and Weisberg, along with many, many lay people who served for years. Dr. Willis was my vice president. Anyway, this Heart Association turned out to be one of the best in the state. We were recognized for our education program, for our community service. We gave out penicillin to all rheumatic children for many years. This is one of our services. We were allowed to keep it. I kept it right here in this house. And people came and I gave it to them. Any little children. I organized those Heart Fund drives. You probably remember them. And we had a great association. It's still going on today. And some of those people on that first board are still in touch with me. Now it seems there should be something else about that Heart Association. We did collect lots of money for research and had a great education program. I gave talks all over the county to the Lions, to the Rotary, and to the Homemakers, many, many groups. I gave talks about the Heart Association as we got started. So today it's a very, very great association. It's grown tremendously, raises thousands of dollars, and I think it all started way back then. Okay, I'll turn it off now.
Why did you become so involved with the American Heart Association?
Well, I really became involved because my husband, Bill's father and uncle, Stanley and Emery McComas, who own McComas Brothers, had both died very suddenly with heart attacks. And I thought I should give some time to this. And that's when I said yes. And it was a wonderful experience for me. Of course, dear Bill didn't die from heart. And you probably don't remember Emery and Stanley. Oh, I don't remember Emery and Stanley. But all the old timers do. They were great singers. And they would go around and sing. Bill said that oftentimes other people in this quartet would call and they would sing over the phone just to have fun. The great people. I've always stayed very close to St. Margaret's Church and helped in many, many ways. We had a fall festival many years ago. I helped organize this and with Betty Wilson of Forest Hill. She and I did that first fall festival. We had it in the armory, and the men served an Italian spaghetti dinner. One of the men, Bob, had wine, and he got a little too much wine, and the spaghetti burned a big pot of it. Well, I was so angry. Bob Turner, he probably knew the Turners. Well, he was so likable, I really couldn't get mad at him. But later he came up and he gave me this little pitcher and he said, this is a gift, I'm so sorry, the spaghetti burned. But anyway, that was great. They still have a fall festival, but the first ones were held in the armory. Okay, I I was a charter member of the Legion of Mary, and that's a group of people who meet every week and do work in the community. They visit the sick, they visit the hospital, nursing homes, take communion, do hours and hours of work. I was a charter member of the Legion of Mary of St. Margaret, and I'm still a member of that. We had a First Friday group, and this is an important part of St. Margaret, a First Friday group of seniors who meet once a month. They have mass, a luncheon, and a program. I served as chairman of First Friday for many years, and it grew to be about 200 people come every week. But I had fun with them, and our theme song was Joy, Joy, Joy. I still see some of the old people, and that's what they call me. They sign cards. Joy, joy, joy.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, then, much to my distress, St. Ignatius Church was closed down because they thought the roof couldn't stand it and it was going to fall down. And I had been baptized in that church, and I, along with some other old-timers, Mrs. Street, Mary Street, Louise and Kent Wilson, many others, and we decided that they would have to do something about it. We couldn't dare let it be closed. So we organized a very good committee and went to the Cardinal and got a contractor, Donald Hawkins, who put steel beams through that church. Everybody said it was impossible. But he went through a little window up near the eave and put steel windows in and shored up that roof. It's still there today. Suppose they had closed it. Look at it today.
Mm-hmm.
They have thousands of families out there and building the new church. Anyway, I served as the chairman of that first parish council out there once we got it open. And we got a priest, Father Slade, come up, and he was the pastor. I served on that parish council, the first one they had, got all the committees organized, like the cemetery and the finance committee, all of them. And we got that church going again. Then Father Slade died very suddenly, and it's gone on. But I'm back in Bel Air now. But I'm so glad we did that. I think it's an awful thing if that little church had just been closed forever. Don't you agree?
Absolutely.
Have you seen the new big one there? Oh. You'll see 800 and big place. Okay. I don't know why I seem to be charter members so many places, but I guess people would ask me, and if I thought there was a need, I would go. I was charter member of the Seraphim's International of Bel Air. And this organization is made up of business and professional women involved in community service, the environment, human rights, and education. I serve many capacities with the Seraphim International. And they, in 1988, they recognized me as a woman of distinction. This was quite an honor. I'm not in Seraphim now because as I got older, I just can't keep up with too many things. And then in December of 1987, the Paris Pastora Cataract and Laser Center honored me by presenting me the Gold Maid Award. And they said it was awarded to me for quiet service to the community in projects which have helped hundreds of persons. And I think one of the reasons I was awarded that was my work with so many organizations. But I took in a Vietnamese family. That was the best thing I ever did in my life, I think. Besides marrying Bill McComas and Tom Kelly and having Billy. But one day, a friend of mine called and said, Leanna, the church is trying to adopt a family, a Vietnamese family, and if you know of a house that might be available, would you call me? Well, I hung up the phone. Now, my husband had just died about a few months prior to that. I had that big house over there. That's where I lived. I had that big house. It was empty. I hope you didn't hear. And I knew I had the house. I knew it had room. This family, I think it was, they had 14 people coming. And at those camps, they couldn't find any church or group that would adopt 14. And so I called her back, and I went down to talk to Father Carey. And, you know, this is strange, but only a step away, I'd gone to Mass, and I said to myself, I'm really bothered about this. I should say yes to that family, but I can't get involved. I was so sad after the death of my husband. But I said to myself, if Father Carey comes back out on the altar after Mass is finished, I talked to him. And I sat there and I waited. And finally, after about 10 minutes, I got up to leave, and I was within one step of that back door going out. And Father Carey came back on that altar. I turned and went up, and I told him my situation. And you know what he said? He said, Leanna, whatever you do, it'll come back 100-fold. And I didn't question it. I wasn't looking for 100-fold, but he was saying, yes, do it. So I came home, and they arrived in December, right before Christmas, 14 of them. A bus went down to the airport and got them. They were carrying cardboard boxes. They had grandmother with them, and she was about 70, and a crippled aunt with them. And another little girl they picked up on the ship. They were boat people, and she had lost all her parents, and she came in with them, and they had seven of their own children. Well, I have just loved that family. I have just loved them to death. They've all graduated from college. They all have beautiful homes. They were very smart. They worked hard. The father worked at the sewing factory. And the girls went to John Carroll and St. Margaret's and graduated from colleges, all of them. And they have wonderful jobs now. Isn't that great?
That's wonderful.
They're so loving.
Yeah. And you're still in touch with them?
Yes. Oh, my, yes. Now, I'll tell you why they left Vietnam. It's an interesting story. Father was a policeman, and they were in North Vietnam, and when the communists came, they moved further south, and they kept moving to keep ahead of them. And they helped the Americans to win. And then when it looked like the war was over and we weren't winning, Father knew he'd be put in prison because he had helped us. His brothers were put in. And so they got on this boat and escaped. And thank God they did. They've been wonderful citizens.
Wonderful.
I've served on the board of directors for the Cancer Society and received an award from them, presented to me by Art Donovan. Remember Art Donovan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And with my husband, we served Meals on Wheels to the homebound. We worked in the kitchen at Daily Bread in Baltimore. And I've worked with the Martha Dime. And right now, I'm back doing Relay for Life. I'm mailing out all that mail for Relay for Life. I did another thing that I'm really pleased of. One time, the priest wrote me a little note and said, there's a family living in Bel Air, and they're in terrible shape, and would you go see them? And they lived in an awful place with dirt floors, and I went to see them. I said, I have to help them. It was right before Christmas also. And so I found a house for them, and I single-handedly painted that seven-room house. I had furniture and rugs donated, and I got this widow and three children settled in that house. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but I had cancer. And shortly after that, I was like, this family was Filipinos, and I'm still in touch with them. In fact, this week, the mother called me and said that I want some pepper plants. And so she sent her son up with these pepper plants. One girl is in college, another one is studying to be a pharmacist. And that's good that I helped them, you know, to get settled. They now live in Aberdeen, and the house where they did live here was sold. We couldn't buy it. But anyway, I've always been glad that I did that for them. I guess I have to say that I did marry Tom Kelly, and with Tom came six wonderful children, all grown, and I hate to call them my stepchildren because they just like children to me, and they're wonderful to me. And the grandchildren, step-grandchildren, one little step-grandchild was here just last week. She's in New York. She graduated from Harvard in 3 years, and she was just a financial office up there, very close to the World Trade Center. And all day long, as I heard of that bombing, I thought of Cardam and wondered about it. And that night, her mother called and told me that Cardam had escaped by running, and she got out of New York miraculously, and she was due to go to the World Trade Center at 9 o'clock the next morning. Can you believe how close? My stepdaughter, another stepdaughter, was in Washington working, and not too far from the Pentagon, and of course I was worried about her. She wanted to turn that off because she was upset about that, this war we're in, and I didn't vote for President Bush, but I think he's doing a great job.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because earlier you had talked about remembering the so-called sneak attack on Pearl Harbor,
yeah.
Which
yeah.
In a lot of ways was not as much of a sneak attack as it was we just weren't prepared.
Right.
And here again we find ourselves prepared. What could you pass on to folks? I'm talking about this attack that occurred on the 11th of September in New York and the Pentagon, where terrorists attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. What could you pass on from your experience of having lived through a world war of over 4 years and having, you know, witnessed these events happening? How do they compare to what's happening today?
Well, of course, it's a very different war. And right now, it was terrible that they were able to be in this country and to arrange that. So the timing is what got me. That they bombed that World Trade Center 1, and within a few minutes or an hour or something, the second one went, and then the Pentagon. All I can say is this war is different, but I am so grateful for the cabinet that George Bush has around him. I think they're brilliant people, and many of them with experience, and I have a feeling they're going to come out and get rid of these terrorists. I have a feeling they are. I am so pleased that he is so firm about it. And now I'm sorry I didn't vote for him.
Well, one of the things during the World War II time, you all had to sacrifice.
Yeah.
You had to be very focused on defeating the Nazis and the Japanese and the Italians, who were not only enemies of the United States, but of the world at the time. And so what's your advice to people today who have not come through that experience?
Well, I don't think we're going to have to go through that. I'd rather we have rationing now. I'd rather feel things rationing, tired. I think I had an experience just this week, and I'm sad about it, but I think we do have to be alert. I bought gasoline. I go with somebody to fill my tank all the time. And so I went to this station where I've been going, and all of a sudden these two Asian men said they had taken over. I didn't think a thing about it. I thought how wonderful. They filled my tank and were so courteous and nice. But I've been thinking, you know, I guess it's terrible, but you wonder, could they be a terrorist? Or in the sense. And I don't like to think that, because I know there are many, many wonderful people. I have no advice. I just am sorry that we're in another war. And this business of the anthrax, that this morning's paper said now they found a person in New York. But anyway, I have to talk about Kelly a little bit. I met him in a nursing home in New Jersey. I had a brother-in-law who worked for Johnson & Johnson in the New Brunswick office up in New Jersey. And he had a brain tumor. And he was in a nursing home, only 40, 42. And he was in there about 9 months. Didn't know anybody. He said, hey, my sister, a nurse, went every day and spent with him. And Tom Kelly, this man who worked with my brother-in-law, would come every Saturday. And he sat there, and he was so kind. He would tell him everything that happened in the office, although my brother-in-law didn't respond or anything. But he was so kind, and one day I was there. And he kind of took a liking to me. He had been a widower. His wife had died about 5 years ago. And so one time, Warren told my sister that he'd like to take her out to dinner. And I said to her, I certainly don't want to go to dinner. May you go ahead and go. And he said, now, just give me one good reason why you can't go. Well, I didn't have a good reason. There was no reason. He was clever. Well, he turned out to be a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person. And we were married 20 years. And died after prostate cancer operation. It's very sad. But anyway, I've been able to pick up my life and keep going. I'm still, after two bouts of cancer, Hodgkin's disease and colon cancer, and doing just fine until I broke this hip in July. Now I'm gonna get over that. I'm gonna start that mowing again. I hate to see anybody out there mowing my grass.
Well, let me ask you this: as you look back at Harford County, what changes have you seen that you think have been good? And maybe what changes have you seen that, you know, maybe you have a little concern about?
Okay. I'm concerned about the building. I'm concerned that we have so much building going on. I'm concerned that the schools are so crowded, and they're using those, what do you call those?
Portable.
You know, and now it seems the schools are built, and by the time they're finished, they're overcrowded. That makes me sad, because I think of the children. My little granddaughter's in a portable now, and she doesn't mind, kids don't mind, but I'm not sure that it's good. But we're not alone. Harford County isn't alone. You know, every county I read is overcrowded. And of course the traffic, you know, I don't drive much outside of Bel Air. Well, people say if you can drive in Bel Air, you can drive in this place. But the traffic is bad. I think the county is good. I like a lot of things about it. You know, I like the government now. Years ago, we just had three county commissioners. I'll never forgive them for one thing they did. They tore down the almshouse, which is called the poorhouse. That was a beautiful, big old stone building. I had social work clients in there. And then one day, they tore it down. They had it bulldozed. That was bad. Anyway, it's been good to me. And I can't see much that's the matter. I think it's a wonderful county. Now, in my 80th year, I'm thankful that I'm able to maintain my own home. I mowed my lawn until July of this year when I fell and broke my hip. I have wonderful neighbors. I love to tend to the garden and the flowers. Had a vegetable garden this year. I just enjoy life. I really feel I've been very, very blessed. I think I've gotten much more out of the things I've done than I've given. You know, I've gotten much more from those people that I've touched. And I have touched thousands and thousands of people in this town, one way or the other. But I know time's drawing near. I hope I live to be 87 like your father and be as well as he is.
I'm sure you will. Well, thank you very much, Mrs. Kelly. You've seen many changes and interesting events, and you've given graciously of yourself to make Harford County a better place. Thank you so much for sharing some of your memories with us.
Well, it's really been nice to see you